We're going to do two things in this session. We're going to try to bring together some of what we've thought about in this kind of genealogy of secularization. Then we're going to define terms that we've been using after having been using them. And then in the second half, I want to introduce you to the thought of Charles Taylor. I think we'll get to his life and thought, and God willing, but perhaps not, we might not get there, to look at a particular chapter together to grasp what he's saying. Am I doing anything wrong? Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you want to come out away from this session having packaged together this into something a bit more coherent, and then to walk away, I hope, people who are inspired to grapple with Charles Taylor with a kind of working knowledge of the way he puts all this together, and maybe some useful things as we think about our ministries and so on before lunch. So I want to come at this story from another angle now. I think I've got a picture on the slides. One along. Yeah, so this is a Civic Video DVD shop in Albany. Who lives near a still active DVD shop? Anyone? You've got one? Okay, cool, excellent. So obviously out of town, so where's that? Okay, there you go, yeah. So my parents live in Albany, which is 400 kilometres south of Perth, on the south coast of Western Australia. Anyone been to Albany? Oh, wow. What? And I don't know, in New South Wales, people pronounce it Albany, but it is, in fact, Albany. That's where I grew up for first 10 years, and Mum and Dad are still there. And so we go to the DVD shop, and every time I'm there with the kids picking up DVDs, well, often we go down, I don't know if you can relate to this as family, we go down and think we're going to have a screen-free week. It's just going to be no screens. We're going to be playing board games and probably reading from Homer's Iliad and just kind of reaching each other in a really deep way. And by about Wednesday, we're like, oh, forget it. And so we go to the DVD shop and get DVDs, and Mum and Dad don't have Netflix. And every time I'm there, I think to myself, I wonder what the staff meetings are like at this place. Like, you know, where they have the weekly staff meeting, or especially I think of the kind of, you know, the quarterly vision meeting when they're casting vision about the future of the organisation, and when, you know, when the boss is saying, look, guys, let's think blue sky. Where could we take this thing? What's the next stage for Civic Video in Albany? And I think about that meeting, I've got a few options. I think maybe they've just got a boundlessly optimistic boss whose, guys, our best years are ahead of us. I can only see this going up. There have been some tough times, but we can see our way through it, and we're going to dream the impossible dream. Don't stare at the steps, step up the stairs. And it's just boundless optimism. The other one, the possibility that I worry about is that they're possibly misreading the data, because, and this is true for those DVD shops that are still alive, Albany used to have about 9 DVD shops. Now it's down to 2, and the population is about 20,000. But as you can think, if you suddenly go from 9 to 2, then your graph is actually looking like this. Because you've got suddenly all this influx of people coming to your DVD shop, and if you lack a bit of analytical skill, you can think, guys, I don't know what's causing this, but this is just going through the roof. And you start to project, say, on a linear projection, 30 years out, this is going to basically, the whole town will be a DVD shop. It keeps going this way. But of course, that would be to tragically misread the data, which is that the reason there's this jump in, you know, Albany Civic Video is because there's this wider, massive and precipitous decline in the DVD market. So it could be that they're just irrationally optimistic, it could be that they're misreading the data, or it could, my guess is that there's a sort of sober realism at Albany Civic Video, that they're just getting together and saying, this will only go so long. I know most of the staff here have got Netflix and you're not hiring, and maybe we can spin it out a few more years, but I'm guessing there's an escape plan for the business there. Which brings me to Christianity in Australia. Because it's worth asking, this is what we're thinking about this week, what is the situation for the churches in Australia? What is the nature of the context in which we operate? How do we read the data that we're aware of in our churches and ministries and mission fields and so on? And in particular, I guess today with a high rate of people who are on at the coalface in Christian and secular contexts. As my friend Tim Adney says, every action in the present embeds a hypothesis about the future. Every action in the present embeds a hypothesis about the future. So if Civic Video is buying more land, that's embedding a hypothesis about where they think the future is going. And I want to add to that saying that every action in the present is based on a theory about the past. So I'll make it personal. Everything I think you're doing in your ministry and I'm doing in my ministry in the present, every action has a hypothesis about the future and is embedded in a story about the past that got us to that moment. And I guess I want to say that because I think this kind of material, the thing we're doing today and this week, can look frivolous if you think, oh, the job is just to preach the gospel and teach the Bible and that will do the trick. And that's absolutely true. And that is, just spoiler alert, that's where this is going. That's what you should continue to do. But there are ways of doing that and there are forms and practices that change from time to time and from age to age, and they're based on those two things, a story about how we think we got here and a hypothesis about where we think things are going. So I want to ask some questions about those hypotheses that are often hidden assumptions that we carry around. One possibility is that it's just fake news, that we talk about decline and we've talked ourselves into decline and we've talked ourselves into this moment that it's all very hard in the West and it looks a little bit hopeless. And that might be fake news. That might not be something that corresponds to the data. In research that Stuart Piggin from Macquarie University has done, and a guy called, it's done a PhD called Hugh Chilton, has work on this. They've noticed that since the 1960s, the two groups, well, I'll ask you, who do you think the two groups are that are most likely to exaggerate rates of secularisation and rates of religious decline? Yeah? Yeah, the Christian leaders and, in this research, Christian leaders and secular historians, the two groups that are very susceptible to exaggerating the rate of secularisation and of religious decline for kinds of different reasons. So church leaders that want to say we're in a crisis, one of the reasons you might want to frame something as a crisis is because you want to release resources, and there's nothing like a bit of panic and a bit of crisis to release resources. And so you might exaggerate or overplay the situation because you've got solutions that you want to foister on people or resources you want to release. And then the other group is, especially Australian historians who hopelessly and radically exaggerate how secular our country is and how under-religious Australia is in all sorts of ways. And they're coming at it. It's like the Baptist and bootlegger problem. Have you come across this idea? That the two people that wanted prohibition in the United States were Baptists, because they didn't want anyone drinking, and bootleggers, because they wanted everyone drinking. And so both those groups were like, yeah, let's have prohibition, because it coming at it from two completely different angles, it worked for both parties. So that's a possibility to bear in mind. I do think I've got six things here to say. Firstly, I want to say, without trying to feed into any sense of panic or whatever, that it is real that I think you can verify the fact that our moment could be called a secular moment, that we live in an age that in some sense can be described as secular and secularising. So the statistical story for Australia, at least, it looks a bit like this. In 1901, about 95% of Australians claimed a Christian religious affiliation and reported to participate in church more than just at Christmas and Easter. So about 95% of Australia claiming to be Christian in 1901. And then that by 1954, it goes down to 89%. So think about that. I don't know, this is the kind of thing you should have a graph for, but think about 95, 96% through to 1954 being 89%. So that's a very slow, gradual decline. Then, is that me? No. Then you have, by 2011, down to 61%. So can you visualise that in your mind? 1954, 89, then 2001, 61. And then between 2001 and 2016, it goes down to 52%. So that, again, you need to visualise that kind of thing you should have a graph for, but you've got a long, slow decline, but that's the direction it goes in, and then a precipitous decline after the 1950s, and then something very dramatic happening between 2011 and now, down to 52%. And so it's probably the case that by the time we measure these things again, we'll be in a country that has either a flat 50% or perhaps a less than 50% identifying as Christian. So that story, I think, seems clear, at least. But now, I'm just going to check on that. Are you hearing weird things? Yeah, okay. Should I pause? Or should I return to the normal mic? Okay. Okay. It's not just your hearing aid. Okay. Oh, so I'll go back to this in a minute. And we're on now. Cool. Can I still hear a buzzing? Yeah. Cool. Maybe that's the alarm. It's way more subtle than Gary said. Because you don't want to be alarmist about this stuff. We're just gently walking away. So that's the story of religious affiliation in Australia. But here's where it gets interesting. That story is not the same story as the churches. So what we're mapping there is people who, on a census or in a survey, identify themselves as Christian. The story of the churches in Australia is in a much more encouraging way all over the place. So the churches go up and down and across. There's decline and times of renewal. So probably some of you even lived through this after World War II. So from 1945 to 1963, almost every indicator in evangelical Christianity is heading north in Australia. So if we were getting together at a conference in 1950, we'd be thinking, what do we do with this growth? How do we manage this growth, and how do we respond to this? And so we think about, I think I used to think about the Billy Graham Crusade in 1959 as this guy that came and lit a spark. In fact, he came at the end of a long process, well, a post-war process of things going north in all things that really matter to us, like church attendance and Sunday schools and conversion rates and so on. So he comes at the end of that, and then something pretty spectacular happens around him. But as that statistic of do you say you're Christian, yes or no, notice that the churches are behaving in a different way to that bit of data, which is just a complicating fact that we ought to bear in mind. Or I can put it this way, between 2011 and 2016, 950,000 people who said they were Christian in 2011 said they weren't in 2016. What happened? That's a very short window, isn't it? 2011, 2016, let's say 900, round it down, 900,000 people said, I'm Christian. Now they say they're not. What didn't happen was that a bunch of people here, 900,000 people, were in our churches, worshipping Jesus, serving the poor in Jesus' name, sharing the gospel, reaching out with the love of God and the urgency of the gospel and saving people from the wrath of God and diligently studying their Bibles. And by 2016, they thought, oh, forget it, I'm going to be an atheist. That's just not what happened. What happened overwhelmingly is that 900,000 people who said, well, what are we, honey? I think we're Anglican or something, or Dad's Presbyterian, and tick that. In that window from 2011 to 2016, those guys grew in their confidence and ability to say, do you know what? Nothing. I don't have to put something. I'm just gonna say that I'm not religious. And that is what happened. But notice that two things. Notice that's very different from saying 900,000 people left your church. That 900,000 people thought, I know what Christianity is and I'm not buying, or I was worshipping Jesus and the Spirit was at work in my life and now I'm out. Or Calvinist, so we're not going to think that. But it's a very different story when you realize that it's a story about identity and allegiance rather than a story about people who once participated in our churches and ministries suddenly deciding that they were out. Second thing, these other ones will go quicker. The story is real. So I am saying that there is such a thing as secularization and that our moment is a secular moment. But it's also a complicated story. So the drop in people identifying as Christian, changes in church attendance, and church attendance has gone down relative to the rise of the population. And religious belief has gone down. But some weird things like religion in politics had a big boost, especially from the Howard to Rudd era, where suddenly God was being talked about a lot in Parliament and so on. And has anyone read Greg Sheridan's book of called God is Good for You? So he talks there about, it's Christina Keneally, is that right? Who, New South Wales, did a PhD or a master's in theology. And she talks about how it was so weird coming from kind of a North American context where that wasn't the weirdest thing in the world to say you've done that, to come here and it's like, what? And the other thing she noticed is that our parliaments are full of people who have real or nominal religious affiliations who are being explained to by a group of people, aka journalists, who have incredibly low religious affiliations. So you walk into a parliamentary situation and for good or bad or whatever, there's quite a lot of religiosity and church attendance and identification with churches on a wide spectrum, people who believe a wide range of things but who are kind of say, yeah, I go to church and I'm this or I'm that. And she said it's just an odd feature of Australian life that group of people are being explained to us by a group of people who really have very dramatically low understandings of insider understandings of religious life. Another one I think is kind of weird, but also you want to bake in there, is a continuing rise in the amount of people who want their children to be educated in religious schools and institutions. So, that's worth thinking about. Who are these people who say, do you know what, I'm not religious, but I want my kids to go to that institution and have access to those resources? And as I say, there was from the early 50s to 1963 were a time of significant growth for the churches in Australia. And so to an eerie degree, the kind of decline that we are experiencing, or the moment that we're experiencing, begins in 1963. And to a weird way, it's not 1962 or 1964. There's this kind of moment, for whatever reason, where it begins to change for us. The third thing to notice, and this affects the way we think about what's on the wall, the phenomenon is pan-national. So whatever it is that is happening happens at the same time and in a very similar way in New Zealand, Canada, UK and Australia. Now, what does that fact bring online or exclude for us? Yeah, that's right. It very, very simple point, but very important point. It excludes the possibility that it's a uniquely Australian thing. So it whatever is happening, it can't be true that the causes are unique and local if the phenomenon is international and across nations. It's like the Albany DVD shop. If the guy in the Albany DVD shop thinks, oh, DVDs are struggling in Albany, but Albany is just an unusual town, there's lots of nature around and stuff like that, I think the DVD market's going to do well elsewhere. He's going to misread the data because, in fact, what's happening in Albany is part of a global phenomenon and movement. One of the ways you see this, maybe people here in this room will remember this, that in the 70s especially, there was a movement called the Gumnut Theology and a lot of work done around indigenising Australian Christianity. So books were published, Australian versions of the Psalms that were sold in the ABC shops and sold very well of people writing Australian versions of the Psalm, people like Mal Garvin, Bruce Prura, John Smith and so on, who were working very hard to present Christianity with an Australian accent, which may have been a very worthwhile thing to do, but it couldn't have been the cause of the change. Do you see what I mean? Because if that thing's happening in Canada and in England and elsewhere, then that can't be the cause of what's going on. One of the things we'll think about, and I want to look at the boards again, is to think about, are the better explanations for our moment top down or bottom up? Are the things that happened in our culture, are they things that have come from elites to the general population that theologians and intellectuals have thought things that eventually made their way down to the rest of us? Or are they mainly bottom-up forces, forces that have been caused by things like what are some of the ones we've had here? The printing press? What are the other technological explanations that we've had on the board?
Radio.
TV. TV, internet.
Car.
iPod. The pill. So you have top-down from minds to actions, or bottom-up from actions to mind. So you think about, lots of sociology is really interested in bottom-up approaches. So Karl Marx, for example, classic example of someone who says, you guys are looking at the world and thinking that there are all these thoughts in our heads that are causing things to happen in the world. And he says, no, actually, there's economic realities that are causing those thoughts and shaping the way that we think about things. So in this space, I think from top-down explanations, you could probably move backwards from the age of authenticity in the 1960s, the expressive individualism of that moment, Darwin's Origin of Species, that people thought differently, or Galileo and the discoveries about the universe, or the Enlightenment, or right down, as we said here, especially around radical orthodoxy, people like John Milbank and Pope Benedict would say that it's kind of William of Ockham and Duns Scotus's fault. That's where things happen. Where the bottom-up approaches, people have pointed to things like the technological revolutions that we've lived through. So Callum Brown, I don't think he's personally a believer, and he's a sociologist. He argues that secularization is much more short and sharp than people have traditionally thought. So we tend to think about a long, slow story, and Callum Brown looks at the data and mounts an argument that says actually secularisation comes very suddenly in the 1960s, caused by the pill and by reproductive technology and the changing roles of women, and that suddenly and precipitously and, in his opinion, irreversibly changes the religious landscape. Or Mary Eberstadt, who argues that secularisation is caused by low birth rates. So there's a long history of saying that secular people have less children and that religious people have more children, and she wants to flip the correlation to causation and say actually it's not that you become secular and then you have less kids, it's that you have less kids, which makes secularisation and secular life possible. And adversely affects religious participation, and so on. I sometimes think about this with the example of the Beatles. You know the Beatles, that they go from "I want to hold your hand" to "Why don't we do it in the road?" And in my mental map, "I want to hold your hand," that sounds like early 1950s. Everyone's family values and stuff like that, and it's very modest and shy. And then "Why don't we do it in the road?" sounds like this kind of 70s like Fat Elvis sort of glam rock moment. And actually, of course, the Beatles, as everyone here probably knows, are kind of operating between 1963 to 1969, 1970, just kind of make it over. This is like a seven-year window from "I Want to Hold Your Hand" to "Why Don't We Do It in the Road." It's a very short and sudden change. I'm going to pause for, you might have questions, but I want to ask you a question. How might it affect the way you approached mission and ministry if you thought in a more top-down or a more bottom-up way about how we got to our moment? That's my question for you, but feel free to ask questions to me as well. What do you think you came here with today? Do you think you instinctively think our moment has been an ideas-driven thing or a technologically-driven thing? Who would vote, if you had to, it's very artificial, but who would say, oh, I think it's ideas, it's that long story, and who would say it's more technology and what's happening in culture? Yeah, okay, and then a lot of, there's a kind of undecided people, is that what? Yeah, no, you can't. No, it's one of the things... yeah, you absolutely can have both, and it is a little bit circular in that someone thought of an iPad, right? Or conversely, the iPad made me think of things that I wouldn't have thought of otherwise. Do anyone want to speak to why they're kind of why they've got that particular approach, or why they're coming at it from that angle? I'm impressed by how even it is. My bias, which I've now been disavowed of, is that I wonder whether as Christians, especially probably a lot of people here as teachers, like as people who teach in various contexts, that we tend to gravitate to a top-down account of things. So I find in the theologians I read, there's a lot more. It's the Enlightenment, it's William of Ockham, it's Origin of Species, it's expressive individualism. And in the sociologists and historians I read, it's much more, it's the printing press, it's iPads and so on. Yeah. Yeah, okay, I think that's just the way I've mentally mapped it. But another way you could think about it, that's right, you could think within the world of ideas, there are ideas that elite smart people have that eventually we all cotton onto, versus there are ideas that the masses have and the elites catch up, you know, later.
So like just being set up with the way the church is operated or, you know, just
secular. Yeah, okay, so you just have this mass movement of people who are like, oh, I'm over this. And then in this way of thinking, maybe like, what is this, like the theologians and pastors are like, oh, quick, I've got to do something because they're all Gonski. Is that right? Yeah.
Is part of the bottom-up thing experiential, though? Like, you can only replace church in your life if you've got something better to do, which comes from having a car where you can drive to the beach on Sunday rather than going to your local church and being part of the community. So the technology drives attitudinal change because it brings new possibilities. And so...
Yeah.
The medium is the message you introduce stuff to the ecosystem. It shifts behaviours, which then works its way up to thinking, which I think you touched on before.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So Marshall McLuhan's a great reference. He says, you know, the medium is the message. That is like what you need to know about television is not so much the content, but the delivery mechanism, which is going to massively shape the content and the business model, which is kind of a thing we're going through in the last 5 years, I think, with the rise of podcasting and so on, which is a really counterintuitive moment where television means it's interrupted every 7 minutes for an ad, and it's a very ADHD kind of culture, whereas the internet, which you think of as like ADHD on whatever it is that causes more ADHD, whereas actually it has delivered something of that, but it's also delivered a 90-minute discussion about one thing and that it's got this huge market, and people in the world of podcasting compete for how much of a deep dive they're taking. That in true crime, you're like, actually, no, we're gonna look at this case over 7 episodes, and which is so different from the kind of the television skittishness. But anyway, there are examples of where the medium is the message, and I think that's absolutely right, that you kind of... Did the change in our sexual mores, to what extent are they driven, and how much are they driven by things like the availability of cars? It was just physically very difficult to get together if you're a teenager, you know, in your respective parents' house. Now there's this third space that's available, or obviously the pill. Yeah. Other questions or any reflections on how it might affect a ministry or a mission approach? Yeah.
So I've got a bunch of youth who I pastor to. Do I want to get them out of cars, or do I want to get them reading more Corinthians?
Yeah.
In terms of what's going to change their sexual practice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Brilliant. So you think, okay, here's a bunch of kids that are finding it really hard to live in the Christian sexual code, let's say. And what's going to change that? They just need more Bible in their heads, they need to know more stuff, and they need more data, and that would reflect, I put that in a pejorative way, I want to say positively, there are ideas in their heads, and if there were better ideas, if they knew more truth and better truth, their way of being in the world would change. Yeah, that's a great one. So a top-down approach, as I'm using this in ideas versus technology, would you, if you thought ideas predictably moved from the top to the bottom, you might as well go upstream and get at the top and put a lot of effort into the Q&A approach. If you didn't think that elites were particularly influential, then... you might just think, okay, let's just put those guys out. That's certainly in politics, that's a big thing. And so John Howard was noted for speaking over the tops of his advisors to people, and one theory on his electoral success was that he was able to ignore the people around him and get to the people who were rocking up in the voting booths. You could have that sort of gut instinct about the average person. And I think that, so Charles Taylor would argue that that changes across cultures. So he would say that in European culture, the elites are much more predictive of what the masses will believe, whereas in America, they're much less predictive of what the masses would believe. So Taylor says, if you look at what the elites teach in universities in Europe, that will quite quickly affect everyone. Whereas Peter Berger, who's a sociologist, he says, you might have heard this, that roughly the most religious country in the world is India, and the least religious country in the world is Sweden. And he says America is a situation where it's a nation of Indians run by an elite of Swedes. And the interesting thing there is that for a long time at least, that's been true and has had very little impact. The elites have had very little impact on church attendance in America. Steve?
The thing I think would be interesting about the Q&A, something that Charles Taylor does say, is that the secular frame writes the rules of engagement and invites the religious frame to play the rules and argue in their own position. So the Q&A, Greg Sheridan's on Q&A tonight, so he wrote Consider Fear and Report and then watch Q&A tonight and beyond. The first stage is getting on to Q&A, but that's not really the issue in one sense. It's when you go to the Q&A, what do you want to be saying on Q&A? So 20 years ago, please don't let it be insert name of fairly fundamentalist preacher here on Q&A, because he'll make us look stupid. And then we've got a situation, we want someone who's going to make us look just like the rest of you. We've got a same vision of human flourishing as you have, with a little bit of addition. But we've been called out.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be Peter Hitchens, or do you want to be, you know, someone who's a bit more
Yeah.
I guess if you think it's a lot top down, you might spend a lot of time over the next few weeks trying to preach about applying and you're preaching about how people ought to vote or something, and what they should value in their politicians. Or if you think it's bottom up, you might still just spend as much time preaching over the next few weeks about how people should treat their neighbours and, you know, demonstrate neighbourly love.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Great example. Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Okay, hey, one more thing, which I think we mentioned earlier, is one of the things that sociology brings online is to work out what are the things that we're measuring. So if you say, we say churches, and you focus on a church, like you focus on the DVD shop and say, this is going in a certain direction, a thing that sociology says is what category do churches fit into, and they fit into voluntary community organisations. It's kind of what they are. And there's a fairly good argument to say that if you think about these kind of three balloons, think about the balloon of the state and the balloon of the market and then the balloon of volunteer organisations, over the last, in the post-war settlement in the West, both the state and the market have massively increased, and that balloon of volunteer organisations, or what they'd call in sociology and theology, mediating institutions, has massively shrunk across the board, like not just in churches, but in all sorts of volunteer situations, which might affect some of our analysis and thinking. All right, I want to give you some of these terms that we've been using, and I want to clarify them a little bit for us, and then we'll have a little wriggle room before we get on to Taylor. So we're talking about secular and other derivative words. So what are we talking about? So the word secular, I think this is an interesting part of the equation. It comes from the Latin secularum, and it refers to life in this world, so life in this space, or more technically, life in this time. So in, to use theological language, our eschatological moment that we live now. We don't live in God's time, which is future. We live in our time. We live in a secular, in the secular, which means as distinct from the sacred. So the opposite of secular is sacred. And the important thing to note here, and Taylor is really emphatic on this, is that that is entirely a product of Christian theology. So the idea that there is a secular realm that is meaningful and that you can operate in, and that has its own kind of integrity and so on, is, he would say, specifically a product of Latin Christendom, of Western theological thinking. So in a way that's quite confusing, in Catholic thinking, you can talk about secular versus religious priests. And a secular priest isn't an atheist. A secular priest is a priest who operates in a parish, as opposed to a religious priest who operates in a monastery. And so secular and religious really is the idea of secular really comes out of Christian theology. It's a product of Christian theology. And one way you could think about our secular age and secularism is as a kind of Christian heresy, or as a line of Christian thinking that goes to seed or turns back, or the daughter going back against the mother. But in a quite a distinctive way, it's really Western Christendom that invents the idea of the secular, even if we think that's the thing we're shadow boxing with. Also in that use of secular, it's worth noting that in particularly in Australia, and so it has that Latin theological history, and in Australia in the 19th century, when all the education acts are getting up across the states, when Australia wants to have a universal secular educational system, universal, secular and free, by secular they mean non-sectarian. So not religious, not to the exclusion of religion, but to the exclusion of sectarian religion, and really they mean not having Protestants or Catholics fighting each other in class. In a way that it's kind of hard for us to grasp now, the history of the Protestant-Catholic divide in Australia is huge, and David Maloof, an author from your fair city, who gave the Boyer lectures in whenever that was. So he's from a Lebanese Catholic background. And he said it's unbelievable to him. There was a moment in the 1990s where Catholics became the largest single religious group in Australia, And he said right through his childhood, that was just this unthinkable kind of eschatological moment that we Catholics would eventually be the dominant group. And the fact that that happened without anyone noticing it is an incredible testimony to how much that has changed, both that sectarian conflict and just the relevance, like who cares what you are, because it's not really impacting how you live. So it's one of the things we need to think about over the course of the week is to what extent the idea of the secular is a Christian a product of Christian theology. Taylor, we'll come to this in a moment, has three types of secularism that he wants to talk about. He talks about secular one, secular two, secular three. By secular one, he roughly means what I've just been talking about, that secular one is just the existence of a secular space, of a place that is where you can be in the world in our time rather than God's time. That kind of more benign use of the word secular. Secular two in Taylor refers to the retreat of God and religion from public spaces. So the sense in which the presence of God, at least the conscious presence of God or the acknowledged presence of God, retreats in Western cultures. And secular three for Taylor is his kind of distinctive contribution. So Taylor wants to argue, and his whole kind of book and his whole project is about the idea that in secular three that we live in an age where belief in God is highly contested, and he wants to think about the conditions that made that possible. So he's interested not so much in, I have a thought in my head that God is real and I pray to him and trust him in my life, and the person next to me on the bus has a thought in their head that God is not real, and we can both talk about those thoughts and say, I think God is real, and you say, I think God is not real, and let's talk about that. Taylor really wants to go down and say, no, what are the conditions of belief that made it possible for those two people to be on the same bus having those thoughts? Does that make sense? So he wants to get behind the thoughts to the conditions of belief, the kind of precognitive situations that make that possible. So secularism, when we use secularism, we're thinking about, I guess, a more active form of secularization where you a secularist is someone who wants the space of secularity to increase and the space of religion to decrease. The secular is a very distinctively John Milbank term. We will think about him especially on Wednesday, but thinking about the secular as almost as a kind of a quasi-religious instinct of its own, an alternative to Christianity that came out of Christianity and is now in competition with it. And the big threat in that line of thinking is that the secular presents itself as unstoried, as a taken for granted thing, and he and others want to call it on that and force it to tell its story. So secularization kind of obviously is the process of a society having more secular space, and it's worth noting here that the increase of secular space is different across cultures. So, for example, you think about the UK and about the Nordic countries, you have a not very secular state in the sense that you have, you know, Lords religious, you have the Queen as the head of the Church of England, you have prayers in Parliament and all sorts of kind of religiosity in the official space. But you have incredibly low rates of personal belief and practice. Whereas conversely, or kind of the mirror opposite, in the USA, you have a very strict separation of church and state and a very widely cherished sense that that should be the case, and very high rates of religiosity, church attendance and belief and practice. Then the secularization thesis. So the secularization thesis, or the secularization theory, is essentially the theory that says that a decline in religion comes with the hardware of modernity. So the simplest way to put the secularisation thesis is to say that if modernising also secularising, that there is something in the factory settings of modernisation that will inevitably lead to a decline in religious practice. The history of sociology is kind of caught up with this. So Emil Durkheim, these are three 19th century figures, Durkheim, Marx and Weber. Emil Durkheim says that what modernisation brings is urbanisation, which leads to alienation. So Durkheim looks at how church functions in a rural community, and it's the centre of people's lives, and the church is in the centre of the village, and you go there for harvest festivals, and it kind of, even if you do or don't believe, it's important that you participate because it's part of the coherence of village life that you're involved. And urbanisation leads to alienation, both from your, you know, from the means of production, and also from your cultural context, and therefore you'll have secularisation. Karl Marx says that you have secularisation with modernisation because the function that religion serves before the achievement of the socialist conditions, religion will continue as long as it's useful. So it's the opiate of the masses. Do you know this passage? Everyone quotes Marx as saying religion's the opiate of the masses. It's worth Googling the longer quote. He says it's the sigh of an oppressed people, the cry of the soul. It's the opiate of the masses. It's a very tender passage in Marx, a very sympathetic reading of religion as this very important, serving this important function of kind of therapy or grief management for oppressed people whose purpose will run out when there's no oppression left for religion to serve. And then Max Weber, for him it's technology, that you enter into this situation where which someone talked about in this storytelling where you know you kind of turn in on light switches and you technology's the world is being much more. Oh, the Black Plague was an example of this, but the extent to which non-religious solutions are found for what were traditionally religiously attended to problems is the extent to which the world will be secularised. But the secularisation thesis, that's the background in the 19th century in sociology, but it's more recently associated with Brian Wilson and others. And the thing to know about secularisation is it's massively contested as a thesis. And maybe you can kind of guess why. What would be the contesting features of saying that modernisation brings secularisation? Where is there data to the contrary of that? Contra Durkheim, actually, urbanisation is often great for church attendance. That I think Durkheim's mistake was that he... I think it's true what Durkheim says, that religion functions in a village differently to in a city, but it's not that you get rid of one for the other. It's just is a different expression. Yeah. Other. Yeah. Another way to say that is basically everywhere else apart from Western Europe. People in secularisation theory from the 60s to the 80s, people would talk about the American exception. And, you know, it really works for Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Western Europe and so on. And America was always this troublesome thing. Oh, they're very religious, but maybe they'll get there, or maybe there's something weird in the water, or there's something there that's just not working. But kind of dramatically not working, because it's the most technologically advanced culture and the most modernised culture. And it's kind of frustrating that wasn't happening. But the other place that it wasn't happening was literally everywhere else. So in Southeast Asia, you have certainly in Islam, more wearing a hijab, more religiosity and so on. And you have a whole lot of places where modernization doesn't move out religion and where the two kind of grow together. So now some people, instead of talking about the American exception to what's happening everywhere, they talk about the Western European exception, which is secularization. Yeah, that's right. And also with, I mean, an interesting thing contra Marx is he sees, as I say, in that very tender passage, it's the cry of the oppressed, the heart of a heartless world, is Marx's word for religion. One of the weird things, which I don't, it seems to be the case that in most Western cultures, yeah, if you divide societies up into thirds, like top third, bottom third, middle third, in terms of socioeconomic advantage, there's more church attendance in the top third than the bottom third. Which, as a follower of Jesus, I'm not like a massive fan of that. I kind of feel like I want Team Jesus to be more popular at the bottom than at the top. And I kind of like, if I was running the world, I wouldn't have it like that. But that seems to be a fairly robust result, which gets rid of two things at least, that religion can only ever function in the way Marx says as therapy, and that the more educated you get, the less likely you are to be religious, which seems at the moment in the West to be the opposite, which really worries me in terms of our mission, what are we doing, but it's an interesting bit of data in terms of what's causing, and it even speaks into our previous discussion about, is it really ideas that are driving these things? And actually, doesn't seem to be the case. Yeah.
The US an exception to that as well?
Yeah, so the US is an exception. Yeah, exception to everything. They paddle their own canoe. So they have high, they have a much more, that kind of Swedish, Indian divvy up. Okay, we're going to, how are we going? Okay, I'm going to race through that last little bit and then we'll have a little break and then we'll get on to Charles Taylor. So this is again a little overture of the course. So we're going to think about Christ and culture. One of the questions that we're facing is that how do you posture yourself toward the culture? And we're going to look at Niebuhr's work, but if you remember, Richard Niebuhr talks about Christ over culture, Christ in culture, Christ of culture, Christ against culture, Christ and culture in paradox. I think that's a really pressing question for us at the moment, because I do think what's happened, and I'm not on the panicky end of the spectrum about what's happening in our culture, but that change of people not identifying as Christian, it hasn't emptied the churches because those guys weren't in the churches, but it does radically change the consensus of a culture and does radically change. So I don't allocate zero to the fact that 900,000 people no longer identify as Christian. That does really affect a culture and a consensus and our posture toward the culture. I think that is reflected in a lot of those book titles like The Benedict Option, That Was the Church That Was, Disappearing Church and The Zombie Apocalypse. They're all, in a way, different postures to the culture. To say the culture has really changed in a way that's relevant to what we're trying to do. How do we relate ourselves to a culture that has so changed? And as we've been doing today, and we're going to go take a deep dive into this tomorrow to think about the history of secularization and where actually the causation effects might be. Theological responses to the secular, thinking about how we relate to secularity and how we think about secularity, especially given that it does present as that sort of default option, doesn't need a story, doesn't need to account for itself. And then thinking about mission in a secular age and formation and church in a secular age. So I want to stop there just so we don't run out of time for other stuff. So there's 5 minutes to think about the stuff we've covered very quickly now. Then we're going to have a little bit of wriggle space. Then we're going to look at Charles Taylor. So any questions or comments about the little journey we've been on today?
secular, whereas they probably were quite religious. And so even just through birth and through education and stuff in the United States, whether that is where the data is skewed, whereas in Australia, and if you're like me and you're Tasmanian, then you're a convict.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, is that part of the difference in America? And
yeah, so there'd certainly be people who argue that's absolutely the difference in America, that, you know, Australia begins as a convict colony and America begins as a, you know, there's a church service on the first time and there's an orgy when our guys land, and that's kind of a different trajectory if you play that out, which I think is certainly, I think that's very relevant to America, that it begins in that way. But I think particularly... not so much because they're Puritan and now they're still sort of Puritan, but slowly losing that. But because they, we're going to look at this in Taylor after the little break, but they never have an ancient regime. America never has that previous model of king and church, and that you could only ever imagine yourself as someone... You couldn't imagine yourself as, a member of your nation if you weren't also part of the religion of that nation. And America it's just this kind of free market from the start, a religious free market, escaping the persecution and so on. And that feeds into what Taylor calls a neo-Durkheimian. So you have paleo-Durkheim, where Durkheim says, I don't know if God exists or not, but let's see what church does in the village. And America never has church in the village. It only ever has, you know, First Baptist, First Presbyterian. And there's this weird kind of agreement that we get to compete with each other and that's okay. And we're still part of the church with a capital C, even though, like, I've got my preference points here. So I think that they seem to be the distinctive features of the states. Yeah, yeah. But other people, immigration is another thing people argue for. But that, you know, we'll look at this in Taylor, but that's a big question, yeah. Yes.
Thinking about mission in the secular age, if sin and repentance can't be acknowledged because of secularism, what about Leonard Cohen's line, "Your own personal Jesus"?
Uh-huh. Keep going with that. So where are we? Yes.
Secularists don't need to know about failure.
Mm.
So I'm just thinking about, can mission move from, still keep sin and repentance somewhere in there, but can it move into, you can know him personally by his saving grace on the cross? Your own personal Jesus. I know Leonard Cohen is mocking the thought in his one line from his song.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. That's really interesting. So that's certainly that phrase, a personal Jesus, reflects a very important line of thinking in this space, which is that we've moved into what Taylor calls an age of authenticity. And in the age of authenticity, he says people have spiritual instincts and desires, but they're navigated personally rather than corporately. So that you would up to the 60s, you would go to your Baptist church, and my parents have always gone to a Baptist church, and they're not particularly enthusiastic about Baptist theology or whatever, they're just Baptists, and they would always go to the town and go to the Baptist church in that town, even if the local Church of Christ was quote unquote better than the local Baptist church, because they were Baptist. And if you said to them, wouldn't your journey be more fulfilled at the Church of Christ? Wouldn't that meet your needs more? They would kind of look a bit askew because it wasn't really the category in which they thought of church. And so I think I'm Gen X. I can still remember people wearing itchy church pants and having to dress up a bit for church, and found that deeply distressing. And and theologized that and thought that's because these people do not understand the intimacy of the Father and the closeness that God has brought us into. But sociologically, it's much more likely that dressing up for church wasn't to do with your relationship to God, but had to do with what you thought you were doing. That is, that you were going, you were performing a public service and you were doing a public and corporate thing. So you dressed in the way that befitted a public duty. And were you going hard after God, to use John Piper's phrase? They wouldn't think of it like that. And they would just think that they were, and that's what you'd call neo-Durkheimian, that you are fulfilling a duty that may or may not reflect on a it was possible to have an evangelical faith or not in that context, but it wasn't really how people thought about church. Whereas the kind of the idea of navigating your own path, that I think I've been in four different denominations, and rightly or wrongly, I lose not an iota of sleep over it. I don't think that's a virtuous thing. I think it's probably just a product of my age in that sense, that that's a typical path of my generation.
A question, you may get to it. Australia, right? We talk about this is pan-national, this whole secular age thing. Feels like we've kind of got a top-down European structure.
Yeah.
Our government, our institutions, that kind of stuff, but a bottom-up approach to technology and content, I guess, coming from America more than from Europe. Does that just mean we're a basket case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what, very well articulated, that Australia is, in some ways, we inherited a kind of top-down, a weirdly kind of, like, you know, we flirted with the idea of the Anglican Church being the state church, and then we even flirted with the idea of the Presbyterians being the state church for one brief shining moment. And but just that wasn't on the map in America. Like, you know, there were state churches in the colonies, but every colony did what it did in the acknowledgement of other colonies that would do other things. And, we are, I think we are a weird situation in that we've got that kind of, someone described the Philippines as a nation that spent three centuries in a convent and three decades in Hollywood. And I think there's something like that for Australia, that we're kind of ostensibly British in basic structures and in a kind of weird relative conservatism that doesn't make a lot of sense for what is essentially a frontier society. So I think it is a bit of a mystery as to how the Australian situation particularly plays out like that. Yeah. Yeah, great question. Let me have a shot at that and then I'll see if I've answered the question that you're actually asking. So the question is, are we and the world or non-Christians telling a similar story about secularisation? So my answer to that is yes, and I think we're both wrong. So tell me if you think this is right. The new atheist story of secularisation, Dawkins, Dennett, Hitchens, and Harris, not so much Harris actually, but anyway, the new atheist story is that basically science disproves God and the smart money is on there's no God because we look for him, he wasn't there, and we've got a method of acquiring truth, and it's a prestigious method that's delivered as technology and it's not there. And so we tend to think origin of species, maybe the Enlightenment, but that's the thing that we're battling with. And that I think the dominant secular story is that Christianity has just gone round after round with science and just been found wanting at every point. And now it's just this punch-drunk, aged street fighter that's just been outgunned and it's just staggering in the ring and about to fall over. And new atheism comes about after September 11 and they say, it's staggering and it's old, but it hasn't fallen over yet, and maybe just a push. We'll get it over the line. And I think Christians have
in the way we do evangelism, apologetics, and mission and formation, have bought into that story and say, no, it hasn't. Like, science hasn't disproved Christianity, and I can show you A, B, and C why it hasn't. And this, and we're doing this. Here's Richard Dawkins here, and then here's, like, I don't know who here, one of us or something, and we're like, yes, it has, no, it hasn't, yes, it has, no, it hasn't, and if I can prove that it has, then you've got to come over here and stuff like that. And the one thing about the new atheists is that their account of secularization is the account of basically zero historians and sociologists. Like, almost no one who asks the question, what causes secularization, comes to the new atheist conclusion. And so I think part of what we might be able to achieve this week, and hopefully at least get our thinking going on today, is that I think that is that's a weird way for us to spend the next 20 years addressing this very marginal take. And that's what I think Taylor, I want to think critically about Charles Taylor, but where he's really helpful is that he says, no, let's think about the conditions that make the thought either there is no God, or more likely on the bus, it's like, it's kind of irrelevant whether there's a God. I can make meaning myself. And he says, what makes that possible? Because it's not, because down here, it's really what Taylor calls the subtraction story. And it's this vision of society where there was this big vacuum cleaner called science, and it just mopped up, it just is vacuuming up all the religion, and there's a little bit in the corner, and it'll eventually mop that up too. And then the room is exactly the same, minus religion. And Taylor says that is absolutely not the case. Like, what you have is a different thing. And it's very, I think, we'll come to this especially on Wednesday, but secularism is very under-theorized. It's got, it's a very, if I can put it this way, a very poorly thought out system, which is kind of borrowing its ethics from all sorts of places and not asking politely or returning it when it needs to or whatever. It's just this, so I think you've got an interesting thing now with Harari, Yuval Levin Harari, is that right? And John Gray, anyway, the whole lot of philosophers are saying, actually, do you know what? If we're going to vacuum up religion, and these guys are fully functional atheists, but they say, if we're going to vacuum up religion, the room doesn't look like you think it looks. Because human rights and the way you think about equality and the way you think about, it's made up stuff that, and keep it if you want, but it's not from the minusing of religion. Yeah. Was that in the space of the question that you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, actually, not the last bit. The bit where I was actually addressing it. Was I addressing it?
I think so. Okay. As we look around at what's happening from the inside of Christianity, and then we talk about that, is that how similar or different is that to what people perhaps outside Christianity describe what they see happening from the outside?
Yes, yeah. And my little answer to that is, I think we can fall into a trap of thinking that the new atheist account of secularization is also our account, and it's just a simple yes it is, no it isn't thing. And I think the average person mentally says that. If you press someone and say, what do you think, have you noticed that people aren't as religious as they used to be? Yeah, I noticed that. And why do you think that is? And they're, I don't know, maybe science or wealth might be the other one. And actually, funnily enough, neither science nor wealth are very credible accounts of the data that we're dealing with. Yeah. Cool. All right. Let's have a little wriggle. So it's 10 past 12. We're going to finish at 1 for lunch. So just like literally 4 minutes. So just enough to smoke a cigarette very quickly and then come back in and then we'll start. Don't do that. So this is the one I was wearing.
Yep. So, yeah, okay. Well, was it popping or what?
It was making just a kind of hissing, sort of a hissing sound, I guess. Yeah.
Might have been too much volume on the mixer.
Maybe, yeah. That I feel a bit out of my depth with knowing the answer to that, but might be something like that, yeah.
Because You were very comfortable standing over there talking to us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So if I could use that, I'd be glad to. Yes, absolutely. All right, this is what we're, I want to spend just the last 45 minutes kind of orienting ourselves, and hopefully especially for people who are here for the day, giving a bit of an overview of Charles Taylor and his work. I've got a quote here from Seneca as we started. We got the slides. I want to say that this course, and even what we've been doing this morning, although we haven't been fully acknowledging it, is really a whole week given over to reading Charles Taylor and to reading one book of Charles Taylor's. And I just wanted to justify that in a very defensive way. So this is Seneca in his letter on discursive reading. And listen to what Seneca says. This is him to, you know, whoever he's writing to, contemporary of the Apostle Paul, first century Roman. And he says, "The primary indication to my thinking of a well-ordered mind is a man's ability to remain in one place and linger in his own company. Be careful, however, lest the reading of many authors and books of every sort may tend to make you discursive and unsteady. You must linger among a limited number of master thinkers and digest their work if you would derive ideas which shall win firm hold in your mind. Everywhere means nowhere. When a person spends all his time in foreign travel, he ends by having many acquaintances but no friends. And the same thing must hold true of men who seek intimate acquaintance with no single author, but visit all of them in a hasty and hurried manner." This is, by way of personal confession, every word is a dagger
in my heart, because it's the opposite of the way I've approached my reading life. I've been joking about ADHD because I am ADHD, and that's in my reading. That's just like even when I'm reading something, I'm thinking about the thing that I could be reading, and like I think, oh, never mind the depth, feel the breadth. Like it's not very deep thought, but look how much of it there is. And so I'm trying to rehabilitate myself and my thought life around these terms. C.S. Lewis, you remember, says a similar thing about reading old books, that you're much better off reading books outside of your century and ones that are tested. Whereas a lot of the books that we're reading, probably the test of time will judge them very poorly. So this is my justification of spending so much time and attention on Charles Taylor's A Secular Age. Taylor is one of those figures, Charles Taylor, whose work and study you can't go around, you have to go through. So in this field, in what is the secular, secularization and so on, you can't go around Taylor. So imagine this, if you know theology, that you imagine doing a study of desire without reference to Augustine. Or imagine doing a study of justification without reference to Luther, or a study of first century Judaism without reference to E.P. Sanders. I think all three of those, even if you profoundly disagree with Luther or Sanders or Augustine, you can't go around them. You have to go through them. And I think in Taylor and in his book A Secular Age, we have that sort of figure. I don't know if anyone can testify to this. Has anyone noticed this, that you just get Taylor bombs all through everything else you're reading in this space? Anyone testify to that? It's just he comes up again and again. So I think to go deep into him is going to serve us better than flittering around all over the place, especially when most of the other guys stole their stuff from him anyway. It's a book without a subtitle, which I think is, like Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion. It immediately communicates everything you need to know about the book. And A Secular Age, similarly, is like that. So we're looking at him because of his influence. He's a seminal thinker in our field. And people from Tim Keller to Mark Sayers to Andrew Root to Sam Chan are all endlessly referencing Taylor. So I feel at this level of study, we should read the man himself. Secondly, I'm a great believer in this close reading of primary sources. I think reading primary sources is a much more powerful experience than reading books about primary sources. I discovered this reading. I remember once on a train, I'd read endlessly about Plato, and just thought, and I was eventually thought, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to read Plato. And I remember feeling physically apprehensive. And the moment you say, I read anything, why did I read all the other guys? This is way easier than anyone who's trying to explain him. Like actual Plato is way more straightforward than commentaries on Plato. It's also true with Taylor in some ways. Thirdly, of course, I think Taylor is valuable, but I do think he has heaps to offer. So it'll be a generous but critical reading. I think generous because it's the guy's bothered to write a book and we can expect to learn and grow, but critical in a few ways. Taylor's not an evangelical Christian. He's a Roman Catholic, and more particularly, he's not an especially conservative Roman Catholic. He feels free, for example, to liberate himself from historic teachings of the Catholic Church on questions such as hell. And he's a philosopher. He's not a pastor or an evangelist. And as a pastor and evangelist, I'm always like irrationally biased against people who are speaking from the academy into the world that most of us here occupy. And I actually think that plays out in some of his stuff. I think his analysis is brilliant. I think sometimes his solutions are a bit timid and lackluster and just impractical. I want to read him critically as well, because there's all sorts of ways in which his understanding and analysis will be incomplete and contestable and wrong. And one of the things I think you notice, who here has read any of Taylor, like read something that he's actually written, Charles Taylor, you notice that he writes in a particular way. He's very kind of a playful writer. I think the book could have been a lot shorter. It's a huge book. But he writes in a way where he'll say this, 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 and this, and this, and I think that's partly true.
And then he'll start saying, but what about this, 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 and this? And I want to call it this, but maybe I don't want to call it this, because if I call it this, then you'll think that. So I'm going to call it this instead. But, and he has that way of writing, which I think is, it's a bit frustrating if you kind of, I haven't got a lot of time here, buddy. I've got to like preach a sermon by Sunday. But if you allow yourself to move into the way he thinks and writes, it's quite a beguiling and kind of beautiful experience. Fourthly, I think reading Taylor is important because if you've read Taylor, you'll be able to think critically about a lot of the people who are quoting Taylor. So people like Jamie Smith and Mark Sayers and Glyn Harrison and so on all use Taylor's work and will be in a much better position to critically assess their proposals if we've got a first-hand account of the way Taylor himself has thought of this stuff. And fifthly and finally, I'm a really big fan of reading difficult books in the context of a Christian community. His writing style is strangely kind of conversational, but his concepts are really demanding, and I think it'll be really powerful. My constant experience of reading Taylor at the start was I need to talk to people about this if I'm ever going to get my head around it. So I'm really looking forward to that now and for the rest of the week with those who are with us to think about Taylor. I want to introduce Taylor the person, which I think is an important background to understanding him. So who is Charles Taylor? Charles Taylor was a Canadian born in Montreal in Canada. I should say was, is. He's still alive in his 90s. Born in Montreal in Canada in 1931 to a Catholic mother and a Protestant father. Brought up in a Catholic home. So obviously mum won that debate. And in a bilingual French and English home. He studied arts at McGill University and graduated with first class honours in 1952 and won the Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford and did a second arts degree at Balliol College, graduating in 1955. He did his DPhil, which is the Oxford equivalent of a PhD, in 1961, graduated in 1961. And his supervisor was Isaiah Berlin, and he also had contact with Anscombe, who was introduced him to the concept of consequentialism. And Anscombe was a female philosopher who debated C.S. Lewis. And she herself was a very loyal Catholic, but she dismantled in quite a surgical way C.S. Lewis's argument for miracles. And so I think I've done the maths. If Taylor, Lewis went to Cambridge in 1954 and died in 1963, so I think this is kind of remarkable to me, at least, that Taylor would have been at Oxford when C.S. Lewis was there and had done his PhD while C.S. Lewis was still alive and teaching at Cambridge. Does anyone else find that remarkable? Thank you. It's like, you know, Bertrand Russell met Queen Elizabeth and protested for nuclear disarmament. I'm like, how does that even mathematically work? But it's just if you're born at the right time. So it's interesting to think, I think it's a really important factor of Taylor that he was in that post-war world at Oxbridge, and yet is speaking to our world and quoting, you know, Peggy Lee and Madonna and so on. Kind of remarkable. He's a Commonwealth person rather than an American thinker, which I think affects the way we receive him. He's a Canadian born and English educated, which I think it means he has a more direct access to our backgrounds than a lot of US-based authors do. It's a very similar pattern to Australia that you'd go, like, right down to Malcolm Turnbull, get your Rhodes Scholarship, go to Oxford and return. And so I think he has that grasp of non-American Anglosphere. I don't know if you had the same experience where you're reading books from the United States, profiting from them enormously, but constantly having to translate and saying, yeah, but that's not quite the same here, and that's not quite the same here, and that doesn't quite work, and what? And like you say, oh, there's a crisis in America because only 40% of people are going to church on Sundays. And you're like, what? And whereas he's in our world. But then, relevantly, he's also French-speaking Catholic and so has an intimate knowledge of the French religious tradition. And as you know, French secularism is very different from kind of the Anglosphere secularism, a very different beast in lots of ways. He married in 1956, Alba Roma, and they had five daughters. And Alba died in 1990 at age 59. So to me, that's young. Do you think that's young? And sad. I think that's sad to lose your wife at 59. And it means that he never remarried, so he's been a widower since 1990, which I think is worth noting. In 1961, he returns to Canada to teach at McGill, and through the 1960s, he sought election to the House of Commons four times and lost each campaign, including losing against who's the current Prime Minister of Trudeau? Yeah, he lost against Trudeau's father, who represented a different tradition to him. I think that's really fascinating that he had four cracks at it. I don't think I'm that resilient, and that he had that kind of vision to be a public Christian and to participate in politics. I guess as a kind of philosopher, you know, a kind of kingly philosopher or something, but was barred from that. And you notice a few times in his writings, he never refers to that, but he is engaged in politics in kind of a distinctive way. Through the 70s and 80s, he gets all sorts of prestigious fellowships and positions in the UK and America, and even in India, he has a teaching post there. In 1989, his first major work is The Sources of the Self, The Making of the Modern Identity. And that book, 1989, Sources of the Self, is a major philosophical study into what defines a human and particularly the modern Western human. So what is this? What is this creature of Western thought and culture? He gives a series of lectures for Canadian Broadcasting on the malaise of modernity, where he explores modern individualism and what he calls the age of authenticity, the post-60s world. And then in 1999, he delivers the Gifford Lectures, very prestigious, at Edinburgh University, on the topic Living in a Secular Age, which becomes A Secular Age, which is published in 2007. So the point I want to take away there is that he's dealing with these ideas for like 30 years, from the making of the self to the malaise of modernity to giving these lectures in 1999, and it takes him to 2007 to publish them. It means he's Isaiah Berlin, who was his supervisor at Oxford, has a famous essay called The Fox and the Hedgehog. And he says there's two kinds of thinkers. There's foxes that are running everywhere and doing all sorts of stuff, and there's hedgehogs that just know one big thing. And I think Taylor's that kind of figure. I think if you think of Luther versus Calvin, Luther is a fox just running around kind of crazy blogging, unbalanced, unhinged, like some good stuff, some stuff like, oh, and yeah, bloggers, that's right. So I think of Luther as this kind of crazy blogger. And with Luther, there's kind of early, middle and late, and people don't want to talk about late Luther, because if you know late Luther, you won't want to touch early Luther with a barge pole. And then you have Calvin, who is, he's got one big thing. Like, he's working on the Institutes and he's kind of nursing this thing, and it goes through multiple things. So by the time you're reading Calvin's Institutes, you know that is the mature, settled thought of Calvin, which again, I think is weird. You know when he's like dissing on someone and he's saying, oh, this guy's just vermin and he's disgusting. I like the fact that 20 years later, he was like, yeah, I like that. I think... That was in no way unmeasured. I think I stand by. So even though Charles Taylor writes in this kind of conversational, playful way, he sat with these ideas for a long time, and I think you can be very sure that A Secular Age is a mature statement of something he's thought about for most of his life. So it's published in 2007, and it's been highly celebrated and awarded and read and debated ever since. I don't know enough about the Catholic world to know how it was received on Team Catholic, but for Protestants, it's been a hugely influential book. James Smith writes a book called How Not to Be Secular, which is a guide to reading A Secular Age for evangelicals and Pentecostals. I've mentioned Tim Keller and Sam Chan and Mark Sayers, who are littered with references to Taylor. The Gospel Coalition in 2017 does a 10-year anniversary, 10 years of reading and applying Charles Taylor. So think about that there's a book about having this book for 10 years and how that's been applied and what's happened. So this is a hugely influential and important book. It's a long book. It's over 800 pages. And also the print is very small. So it's not just 800 pages, but it's like small print 800 pages, which I think is kind of cheating. And his question is, what does it mean to say in the West that we live in a secular age? Or the other way he puts it is he says, in 1500, so think about our timeline, in 1500, it was difficult, almost impossible, not to believe in God. Western culture, 1500, almost impossible, he says, not to believe in God. 2019, he uses the year 2000 for neatness. 2019, it's now difficult to believe in God, that most of us who believe in God, I think probably everyone in this room, what Taylor says is that many of us are aware that that itself is difficult, that to believe in God is something that we are quite conscious of. I'm a believer in God. I trust God, and sometimes I wobble. And even if you don't wobble, you still believe in God in a way that has to be aware of vast swathes of people who don't, and who, as a result of not believing in God, are not necessarily a threat to you. That somehow they're on the bus and you're on the bus, and your question is, you don't feel immediately under threat knowing that half the bus is secular. Which means, this is what Taylor says, that belief is possible in a way that's coherent and meaningful, in a way that in 1500 you probably couldn't imagine what a coherent and moral life would look like apart from belief in God. And so Taylor's question is, how did that happen? How did we go from that to that, and what made that possible? And I started the day by saying we're about the nuns, but that was a bit of a red herring, because we're a bit about the nuns, but we're also about the way the nuns affect all of us, because our formation and our discipleship is affected by the fact that you don't have to be a disciple. And it affects the way we think about what it is to be Christian, and how voluntary that is, and how fragile it is, and so on. So we're speaking not just about tricks for winning people who don't believe in God, but a wider question of how does formation and discipleship and evangelism and apologetics work in that sort of context. I think I've got this quote on the slide. He says, "The change I want to define and trace is one which takes us from a society that was virtually possible not to believe in God to one in which faith, even for the staunchest believer, is one human possibility among others. I may find it inconceivable that I would abandon my faith, but there are others, including possibly some who are very close to me, whose way of living I cannot in all honesty just dismiss as depraved or blind or unworthy, who have no faith." So that's the space Taylor wants to occupy. We've talked about secular one, secular two, secular three. He talks about his history of secular one, and he wants to talk about the way we've gone from a disenchanted world to an enchanted world. An enchanted to disenchanted world. So a world that was animated by more than human minds, a world where it made sense to beat the bounds of the parish, to steal the host and give it to your sick farm animals, and so on. And he said we've moved from a enchanted world to a disenchanted world. He doesn't mean Disney. He doesn't mean like a cute to an uncute world. He means a world with agency apart from humans, to a world with only human agencies and possibly God as the only exception to that. This was shaped by the ancient regime, the Aetion regime, which had this important system of hierarchy. So before 1500, of sacred time, and the knowledge that you participated in society by walking into a role that was already determined for you. So if you're a peasant or royalty or a warrior, that role was set up for you at the start, and you knew that that role connected you to a wider culture in which you participated. Possibly you were oppressed and it was a horrible role, but it was a role which meant that in the enchanted world, in the ancient regime, of all the things you lost sleep over, you never lost sleep over what should I do with my life? Who am I? What's my identity? Where do I fit? Is there any meaning? Taylor says, on the contrary, that if there's any problem with that world, there's way too much meaning. It was like meaning everywhere. And so Luther's riding his horse and there's a lightning storm, and that's definitely God judging him for not becoming a monk. And so that world, which someone was talking about this before, that world is just radically different, a world where you have a lot of guilt and a lot of shame and a lot of meaning and a lot of purpose, and we have maybe less guilt, less shame, massive angst over a lack of meaning and purpose. That world, says Taylor, allowed humans, I'm summarising the whole book very quickly, meant that humans in that world are porous selves. So a porous self is a self that's open to external influences. So the bile in your system is not just a metaphor for depression, it is depression. That's the thing that's making you sad. And you could be attacked by this, that, and the other, and you have a lot of protective religious ritual because you live in a vulnerable position where you could become under attack. Whereas we live, so Taylor says, we've gone from being porous selves to buffered selves. So we're now buffered from the influences of the external world. And as I say, Taylor really wants to ask the question, what are the conditions that made that possible? Or to use his term, what is the social imaginary? So he's not saying, what do people think? I have a thought that Christianity is true and you have a thought that Christianity is not true. But what is the way I read the whole world that means that it's possible for me to think that Christianity is true or not? How have I mapped the world in a way that means both of those options are available to me? And he wants to reject, the reason the book is 800 words, is that he wants to reject what he calls the subtraction story, which we've mentioned before, the story, very popular, but very non-empirical, as in there's not much evidence for it, that our society is what it would be minus religion. Get rid of religion and you get this, and he says that just doesn't fit with what we see in the data and so on. And so he tells this much longer story of the turn to deism, of the disenchantment of the world, of a world that begins to attend to causation in a closed universe, leading eventually to a widely available option of what he calls exclusive humanism. So he says it is now a widely available option in the West to be an exclusive humanist, by which he means someone who believes that they can flourish in a human life without any reference to any transcendent reality. So you live in a frame where there is no reference beyond myself. There is nothing that I need to sacrifice for. There's nothing in exclusive humanism, he says, there's nothing external that I could say that transcendent claim on my life means that I could sacrifice, or there's something more important than my immediate human flourishing. He says that's a widely available option, and he said of no previous society was that true. So he says no known society has ever generated that, let alone generated it as a widely available option. So you could say that maybe the Stoics pulled that off, or maybe the Epicureans, but as a widely available option that non-intellectual elites can easily adopt and live out, he said that's a new thing that came about somewhere between 1500 and 2019. That's my summary of Charles Taylor. Do you want to ask any questions before we have a brief look at the particular chapter 12? Any questions about Taylor the person or the book? Yes.
Just a little bit on that very last statement. So
Yes.
So what does it mean that so there's no slave in the first century who's able to think purely of individually without thinking I've got these family ties that have a grip on me that's greater than myself? Is that the kinds of things that he's talking about? Or what kinds of things ripped universally that he could say no culture has done? Like I don't know if that can be answered in this way.
Okay, so asking the question, how is it? So he makes the claim that exclusive humanism was not an available option, has never been before, and now it is in our culture, and it's a new thing. So what he's particularly saying there is that with no reference to transcendence. So if you think in Buddhism, in Islam, in pre-axial religion, which is the word for the religious sensibilities before the rise of those big world religions, all of them had in some sense some reference to transcendence, that is to something outside of us, that in some way impinged on, in different ways. So in Buddhism, it might mean that that certain priests in Thailand kind of do vicarious religion for you. They do the hardcore stuff and you kind of back that team to do that. So it's not saying that everyone outside of exclusive humanism were living these lives where they were sacrificing massively toward their gods, but that transcendence somewhere was impinging and shaping what people did and how they behaved and how they lived and how they thought. And he's saying that we're now in a situation where that's not true. So the slave in the first century, he or she may well, but they'd sacrifice for their children, for their thing. They do virtuous acts and so on, and they would have some transcendent reference point beyond exclusive humanism, beyond this world. That they may be enthusiastic or not about. They might not be particularly religious, but the whole framework was set up with transcendence, and he's saying that we've got rid of, we've made it a widely available option to not reference anything beyond ourselves. Is that? Yeah. Cool. So he's not at all passing judgment on, like, people used to be virtuous and now they're not, or people used to be into stuff beyond themselves. He just says that beyond ourselves, we don't have to invoke a transcendent reality. Yeah. Yes.
But then he also said something about it became available somewhere between 1500 and 2019.
Yes. Yes. And so Taylor has a whole, so he says, his rough story is to say the main figures are, so the Reformation shakes up that sense that you have to be part of the church, of Mother Church, and that there are possibilities within Christianity of how to configure Christianity. The Enlightenment and deism making it possible. So deism is a really interesting point, because in deism, you can still people thinking, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in the Trinity or the Bible or Jesus or whatever, but I can't possibly imagine a situation where there isn't a transcendent God that is somehow making it possible for we the people, you know, under Almighty God to do this thing. And he has that a long slow thing to saying where in the 19th century, that option of exclusive humanism is available among elites and widely, but not universally subscribed. And then in his telling of the story, quite dramatically in the 20th century, and particularly after the 1960s, that possibility goes viral and becomes widely accessible. Yeah. So I think his story would be long, slow. That's an important thing. And suddenly it goes... It blows up, as they say in America, which turns out to mean a good thing. Gets better or gets popular, as well as a bad thing. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this will be a big feature of the week. So he wants to think, what's it like to be that? He wants to think, what's it like for us to live in the knowledge that my option isn't the only available option, and some people find many other options. Take home or thing to pursue in our respective ministries is that he thinks the arguments for atheism as such are really weak. Like he just thinks he's a very generous author, but he's just like, it's amateur hour, these kind of arguments that Richard Dawkins and so on put forward. And exclusive humanism doesn't mean atheism, it just means functional atheism, that you don't worry about the existence of God. And his big thing is he thinks it's massively under-delivered at the point, well, theoretically it's under-delivered, like it's just not, they're not very good arguments that sustain it, and it's massively struggled at the point of creating meaning and purpose in people's lives. So he thinks that's the weak underbelly. So if you're thinking about secularism as the Death Star, and you're trying to think where do you shoot, if you've got one shot at it to take down the Death Star, you go for the meaning and purpose thing, because he said it hasn't and just can't seem to deliver on that front. Yeah, I don't know that he specifically addresses environmentalism, but he would take it seriously as a. So he talks about a move from spiritual but not religious, that especially in the last two or three decades, that's been a thing. I don't identify with a particular religion, but I am spiritual, and I imagine he'd put it in that category and would probably take it quite seriously as a groping toward a transcendence that we seem to want, even when we reject traditional religious solutions. Yes. How does Romans 1? Yeah, so that would be I'm reformed theologically, so that would be that's what I would go for, in a way that he doesn't seem to have that same instinct. But that Romans 1 does say, yeah, the knowledge of God is available to us, and we've suppressed the truth in unrighteousness. And that's certainly where I'd go to think theologically about the essential God consciousness of humans. Yeah. Hey, I don't know if he does particularly with Romans 1. But yeah, I think that would be a worthy place to head toward. Let me just two more things, and then we're going to break for lunch. We were going to look at chapter 12, and I think there's two things here that I can show you. What's the next slide? So the other little trick for young players, if you're reading Taylor, I can just like zoom through 1 to 11. So they're kind of interesting, but they're, if you're wanting to think, where's the stuff that actually lands in contemporary application, I reckon it really starts in chapter 12. And chapter 12 is where Taylor really starts to grapple with the question of the secularisation thesis, which obviously he kind of rejects. If you see on that page with the box there, the little table, if you're following along in the notes, he has this helpful take, I think, that so secularization theory or thesis says that modernity leads to a decline in religion, and he wants to push back on that. And he says that what modernity does lead to is a decline in transformational perspectives, that which is to say that it leads to a decline in the idea that transcendence is where you would find the resources for transformation as a human. It has that three-stage thing where he says the ground floor is the phenomenon of secularization, and he says there's wide agreement there. So has God evacuated the public spaces? Do you have to have an encounter with the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob to be fit for public office in Australia and so on? And that area seems to have been opened up, the secular space. And so he agrees with traditional secularisation people there, but he disagrees with the basement and with the first floor. So the basement, if you think about this metaphor, what's going on underneath that's led to an increased secular space? And the traditional story has been roughly science, that we found this alternative way of explaining the world, and it's delivered iPhones and all this cool stuff, and so we can't really go on with religion. And Taylor is like, that's not what happened. That's like a made-up thing. And actually, what happened is a much more complicated story with a series of very contingent decisions and movements and events that have led to where we are. So it's not just taken for granted. There's a whole story that's got to where we are, giving us a social imaginary to make sense of our world. Agrees with the ground floor and then disagrees on the first floor, which is to say what happens next. And the traditional secularization thesis says the punch drunk street fighter that was Christianity is about to topple. And Taylor says, actually, that's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is Christianity will morph, transform. Christian communities will do new things. A supernova, he says, of options will emerge, and some of them will fall by the wayside and some of them will take up. But he thinks that religion in general and Christian faith in particular will definitely survive. And then I'm going to give you this last, table. It's on that second to last page. This is him comparing. So chapter 12 is about the age of mobilisation, which is basically the 19th century, the Victorian era. And he says the ancient regime was grounded in higher time. It thought about a cosmos of meaning that gave meaning to our world, whereas the age of mobilisation is grounded not in the role that was set for you before you were born, but in the moral modern order of mutual benefit among coexisting equals. So our social imaginary changes from thinking, okay, there was a role called peasant, and for my 70 years I occupied the role of peasant, to thinking I am an individual that then opts into society and makes a whole lot of decisions, and our morality is not around keeping the hierarchy and the structure in place, but acting in mutual benefit to each other as equals. So the role of the individual pre-exists the individual. There's a role that you go into, whereas in the age of mobilisation, we have massive agency and we create, or we're forced to create, new structures. In the ancient regime, pre-19th century, it's an organic society with nobles and clergy, with institutions and smaller parishes, and you can only belong to the whole by knowing your place within it. So I had a friend, this is an exact thing, but I had a friend from Thailand, became a Christian, and he was out here in Australia, he was at our church for a couple of years, and I thought to myself, I was being like this kind of, I think of myself as this kind of cool, highly accessible pastor that is always called by his first name. Of course it's Rory, and of course I'm helping with the dishes and like bunging in with church life, right? That's what you should do. And he said at the end of the 2 years, because he wanted to call me Pastor Rory, and I'm like, no, just call me Rory. And at the end of 2 years, he said, it's taken me this long to be able to even operate in this world, because in Thailand, every conversation you're trying to think, is this person above me or beneath me? So there's the king to the beggar on the street, and every interaction is related to the fact that this person is my superior, inferior, older, younger. And for him, not letting him call me Pastor Rory was kind of cruel and not at all Christ-like or helpful, because for him it just meant we couldn't even start the relationship in a meaningful way. And that's my illustration of the ancient regime to that you go from thinking, okay, I might not like my place, but I've got a place, to thinking I could do whatever I want, and as long as I don't get in your road, that's how we work. So it's a direct access society rather than a hierarchical society. Religious environment, enchanted to disenchanted.
The social category, this is one I'll finish with, from paleo-Durkheim to neo-Durkheimian. So these are important categories in Taylor. So remember, Durkheim says, don't care whether religion or Christianity is true or not, I just want to talk about the function, and it kind of binds people together. And so I can't think of myself as French or Swiss apart from the fact that I'm a member of the church, and I go to the parish, and the parish is connected to the cathedral has a bishop, and it all connects up. The neo-Durkheimian world, which comes about in the 19th century, is a more complicated one where you say, okay, I'm going to go to the Baptist church or the Anglican church or the Presbyterian church, and I realise that we kind of bit different from those guys, but I'm still in my urban environment participating in something that is civic and important and doesn't need to be authentic to me because it's doing something important in the community. That in some way it is building social capital, strengthening social cohesion. It's my duty before God and man to participate in this thing. And a degree of voluntarism comes in because you're choosing that you're Baptist rather than Presbyterian, and you'll stick with that for life, but you don't look over the street and think those guys are going to hell and they're a threat to my my community. You're sort of happy that they're there as well, and it's together building this more complicated situation, which the secularization people say that's the only thing religion can do if it's going to survive. So the bias of the secularisation people, like Steve Bruce and stuff, is to say, it's really not true. It's really made up. And so it's going to die unless you can think of an alternative function. So it helps me feel more Italian, or it helps me feel more Northern Irish Protestant, or it helps me feel more civic that I go to church. And if I lose that, if religion, so you look at religion, the places it's done well still is like Poland and till recently Ireland and so on. And sociologists would say, yeah, of course, if it's doing more functions than making truth claims. And that's one of the things that Taylor pushes back on, and I will raise that in the afternoon. 1 minute for a question. Just as a teaser, Taylor's case study for why religious truth claims rather than religious function matters is evangelical Christianity. So he's not an evangelical, but he says, look at the way evangelicalism functions, the way it used to function in Britain, the way it functions in Latin America and Africa, and it flips the secularization thesis on its head. And that'll be the little tension point for after lunch. Shall I say grace? Yeah. Father, thank you for the chance to be together with brothers and sisters and to think deeply about our age and how we came to this moment and how we might faithfully hold out the word of life in this moment.